Greetings, and welcome to the Journal of Southern Religion podcast. My name is Art Remillard. I'm the book review editor for the JSR, and I teach at St. Francis University in Loretto, Pennsylvania. My guest today is Andrew Stern, assistant professor of religion at North Carolina Wesleyan College. We will be discussing his new book, Southern Crucifix, Southern Cross, Catholic-Protestant Relations in the Old South, published by the University of Alabama Press in 2012. Andrew, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, your book begins in 1842 with Bishop John England's passing in Charleston, South Carolina. Tell us about this and explain why you started the book here.
Well, Bishop England's passing was really a remarkable event because it brought the entire city of Charleston together. There was really this great sort of public outpouring of grief and affection for the late bishop. And it really exemplified how he had been held in great esteem by people across the religious spectrum in Charleston. And I wanted to begin with that little vignette because my entryway into this topic was Bishop England's diurnal, sort of the journal he kept of his work in the Diocese of Charleston. I read this, I came across it sort of accidentally years ago, and what struck me as I was reading it was that England would sort of casually comment on how he had been invited to preach in Protestant churches, really wherever he went. And that Protestants would come and hear him preach or attend Mass when he was celebrating Mass. And he mentioned this in a sort of offhand way that clearly in his mind, this was no big deal. There was nothing unusual about this. And yet for those of us who study American religious history, this is not the way Catholics and Protestants were supposed to behave in the antebellum period. You know, Protestants were supposed to be burning Catholic churches, not inviting Catholics to preach in their churches. So this was what got me thinking about this topic. So opening the book with the story of England's passing seemed fitting. It seemed appropriate.
Well, you go from there, and we have a specific sort of geographic area that you try to look at, specifically Charleston, Louisville, Mobile. Why did you pick these as your anchors, and how does this make your book and your narrative unique?
Well, you know, the obvious place to focus on when we're studying Catholics in the South is, of course, Baltimore and New Orleans, because those were the major Catholic centers, not only of the South, but really of the whole country, much of the antebellum period. But it struck me that those cities were anomalous because the Catholic population there was really large enough to sustain its own institutions, like it would do later in places like New York and Philadelphia. You know, Catholics could build their own schools, their own hospitals. They didn't really need Protestant support. The cities I looked at, in contrast, had Catholic populations that were too large for Protestants to ignore, but they weren't large enough to, in a sense, ghettoize themselves, to separate from the Protestant majority. So it seemed to me that here were cities where Catholics and Protestants had to, in a sense, face each other and either get along or not get along. And it also seemed to me that these three cities were useful to compare and contrast to each other because the patterns of Catholic settlement in each varied significantly. In Mobile, of course, the Catholics were actually there first through the Spanish and the French presence. In Kentucky, and specifically Louisville, Catholic settlers came along with non-Catholics. And then in Charleston, of course, you had a very well-established Protestant-dominated society into which Catholics immigrated. So I thought, you know, if I find the same patterns of cooperation in three very different contexts, that would seem to demonstrate that there's something going on here that probably holds for the South as a whole, you know, rather than just one particular city. So that's why I focused on those three.
So as these two started to interact more, they had common causes and they had common enemies. And could you talk about that?
Right. Well, I opened the book. The first chapter is really just a series of sort of anecdotes of Catholic and Protestant relationships, prominent Catholics who were respected by non-Catholics in the South. And then I also look at the sort of idea of shared causes, both positive and negative. So shared causes and shared enemies. And I found that, you know, Catholics and Protestants in part got along because they had a lot of common interests. Catholics were active in things like, well, causes in support of the Irish. This was something that sort of surprised me. But many prominent Southern Protestants were very passionately committed to support for the Irish, especially during the potato famine. Temperance movements, Catholics and Protestants were involved in that. Anti-dueling movements, you know, they were involved in that. And then, of course, they shared common enemies, you know, whether it was the Spanish or Native Americans or African Americans, both free and enslaved, and then ultimately the Yankees. So I think, you know, in a sense, that brought them together. You know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, as it were. So that's the first chapter. And, you know, the first chapter is really a little scattershot. It's just sort of interesting stories that illustrate how Catholics and Protestants got along on just really individual, personal levels. And from there, I move into a more institutional focus.
Did you see any differences or similarities between the elite and the ordinary in their interactions and friendships?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's one of those things that's hard to get to, of course, because, you know, the sources tend to come from the elites, and it's harder to see how the ordinary people got along. The evidence that I found for how ordinary people got along in part comes from just numbers. So when there's an account of a Catholic cathedral being dedicated and there are just, you know, mobs of people attending, well, you know, clearly there are working people there. There weren't enough elites to account for these great crowds. Like I said, you know, there were accounts of you know, Southern Protestants showing great concern for Irish laborers. You know, it wasn't just elites. But I think this might point to one of the limits of cooperation. I think cooperation tended to be, you know, elites recognizing elements of themselves in other elites, even of different religions. I remember years ago I attended a talk on the great outbreak of church burnings in Philadelphia. And the presenter, whose name I can't recall, unfortunately, mentioned how, you know, the churches that were burned were working class Catholic churches, not elite Catholic churches. And so that's something that, you know, the evidence doesn't exist, or at least I didn't find it, for broader conclusions. And I do think cooperation extended beyond just the elites. But clearly, I think that we do need to have that caveat that there was an element of class probably in this as well.
I'm betting that the presenter was Katie Ox.
That could very well be.
Yeah,
perhaps this was years ago. It's funny how, you know, certain things just stick with you.
Oh, she's done great stuff on Catholics in Philadelphia and class.
Okay, yeah, it may very well have been.
Okay, well, you know, one of the ways that these two populations interacted was through health and healthcare. And so you look at disease and epidemics and the way in which this gave a venue for Catholics and Protestants to interact. Tell us how that worked.
I propose a number of explanations for why Catholics and Protestants got along so well. And one of them was necessity. In both healthcare and later on I talk about education, you know, the South was slow to develop institutions. And so anyone who offered to come along and build a hospital or build an orphanage, I think would have been well received simply because there was such a need for those institutions. Catholics, of course, had a long history and a reputation as healers, as people who cared for the sick. And they made a great point of trying to build those institutions quickly as a way of sort of demonstrating their usefulness to society. And I think, you know, Protestants recognized that and were happy to support it. Catholics, especially Catholic women religious, developed really great reputations for caring for the sick. You know, the South had just these one horrible epidemic after another throughout the antebellum period. And in each one, you know, you find priests and nuns caring for the sick, more often than not dying through their labors, but really gaining great respect for the church through their sacrifices. There are a couple of cases in New Orleans where, you know, the Protestant ministers flee the city and the Catholic priests stay behind. And although they die, the reputation of the church they represent and serve is enhanced through their sacrifices.
But at times there is discord that comes out of disease. So 1855, you note that there's this mob attack in Norfolk after yellow fever outbreaks, and this is blamed on Irish immigrants. Right. Can you talk about how that maybe complicates things a bit?
Right, and you know, there's this tension in the book. I try to be sensitive to the fact that although I'm talking about cooperation, it's not some sort of utopia of interreligious harmony, that you do have this bizarre tension where on the one hand, you know, Protestants are supporting Catholic institutions, and yet there are also cases where they're burning them. And the two sides coexist hand in hand. This may be, although I'm not sure where class comes into it, you know, it may be the support is more from the elites, the anti-Catholic resentment is more from the working class. That's possible. So yeah, there were certainly cases of nativism, cases of anti-Catholicism. These poor immigrants certainly put a great strain on welfare systems in the South as elsewhere, and sometimes that did lead to resentment. But the resentment, I think, didn't overshadow the cooperation and the recognition of what Catholics were contributing to society.
I see this tension between cooperation and resentment also playing out in the story of Catholic education in the South. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so Catholic education, I think, is even more striking than healthcare in the terms of Protestant support. Again, Catholics had a reputation as great educators. Many of these priests and nuns were, of course, coming from France, you know, sort of refugees from the French Revolution. And they had this reputation as being, you know, very well-educated, very cultured people. So again, many of the elites did not hesitate to send their kids to Catholic schools. I guess probably Jefferson Davis would be the most famous, you know, Southern Protestant alumnus of a Catholic school.
Can you tell us about the Davis story? Because that one stood out to me.
Right. So it's interesting because Davis's time in Catholic schools is really cloaked in myth and tradition. So it's hard to tease out what actually happened. But the story is that, you know, Davis was very close to converting. He attended a Catholic school in Kentucky and apparently was about to come around and was dissuaded by the priests. Getting back to this tension, although many Protestants sent their kids to Catholic school, there was also a lot of fear. You know, what exactly are Catholics teaching our kids? You know, is this just a way for them to sort of brainwash our kids and, you know, make them convert and, you know, make them, you know, start swearing loyalty to the Pope and all that? And so in many cases, Catholic educators were actually very reluctant to allow conversions because they were very conscious of, you know, some Protestants' unease. So the story is that Jefferson Davis was actually dissuaded from converting. He was told he couldn't until he was older. And then once he got older, he sort of gave up the idea. But it nicely illustrates that tension that we were talking about. So Catholic education appealed to elites. Catholic education also appealed to a lot of the destitute because it did not have the same stigma of charity. There were some charity schools in the South. But of course, if you sent your kids there, they were marked. Catholic schools educated many poor kids, but without that same stigma, because they educated poor and elite at the same time. So, you know, Catholic education really appealed to the whole spectrum of non-Catholic society. Although, again, as I said, it also elicited a lot of fears and a lot of suspicion.
Okay, so Protestants supporting Catholic educational institutions didn't surprise me as much as Protestants supporting the building of Catholic worship institutions, as well as actually going to these places. That was probably the most surprising chapter to me. So can you talk about Protestants and Catholics praying together?
Right, and this was the most striking finding for me as well. You know, you could explain away non-Catholic support for Catholic hospitals and schools. You know, you could say, well, it really wasn't about Catholicism, it was about what these things were doing for society. But when you get to churches, I mean, that's obviously, you know, it's about Catholic worship. And there, too, you find Protestants giving really the striking support, case after case of Protestants giving money to build Catholic churches, Protestants attending Catholic churches, Protestants inviting Catholic priests into their churches. And so this, to me, is what really stood out as well. Now, here, too, I mean, there were sort of pragmatic reasons. There were several cases I found of Protestants giving support for Catholic churches, but only if the Catholics promised to build really nice churches. So clearly there was an element of civic pride here. You know, churches are good for society. A beautiful church is a good resource for society. There was also an element of, again, primarily among elites, sort of aesthetic appreciation for Catholicism. You know, this ties into Romanticism, and I guess this is sort of Jenny Franchot's great thesis in her work, Roads to Rome, but although many Protestants were repulsed by Catholicism, there was also something about the aesthetic of it that attracted them. And so, you know, Protestants wanted that. They wanted these, you know, big, beautiful churches with the stained glass, and they were willing to give money for it. So there are those more pragmatic concerns. But at the end of the day, you do find these cases of Protestants worshiping right alongside Catholics. And to me, like I said, that was really striking. It's frustrating that Protestants rarely commented or explained explicitly why they were attending Mass or giving money for Catholic churches. Again, it's striking that it almost seems like they didn't feel the need to explain it. That, you know, it was that common that it didn't merit explanation. So we're left today to speculate about what exactly their motives might have been. And of course, it's probably fair to say that, you know, the motives vary tremendously depending on the individual and the circumstance.
Well, since you're speculating, I'll join on the speculating further.
Sure.
And I It seems to me that this is an era defined by slavery, and one of the ways that Catholics seem to speak to their non-Catholic neighbors was in supporting slavery and opposing abolition. And then, obviously, that goes into the Civil War. Can you talk about how that dynamic played out?
Sure. This is one of the final chapters in the book, and it was, I think, probably the most difficult chapter to write because it was the most complex issue. The Catholic relationship to slavery, not only in the South, but universally, was very complicated, very ambiguous. There's a lot of evidence that many Catholics, especially Catholic prelates and priests, disliked slavery, yet they never spoke publicly against it. So they seem to be walking this very fine line between, you know, trying to become accepted into Southern society, which of course meant that you could not condemn slavery, while trying to ameliorate some of the excesses of the institution. You know, in a way, it's probably fair to say that silence on the slavery issue or complicity in slavery was the price Catholics paid for admission into Southern society. You know, there's been a lot of scholarship on this, that in the South, white solidarity was key. And in a sense, it didn't matter so much what religion you were as long as you were white. You know, that the race was the big dividing line, obviously not religion. Now, again, that is a simplification because, as I said, the Catholic views were so ambiguous and ambivalent. But ultimately, yeah, Catholics did acquiesce. And that's one of the reasons why I think they were welcomed into Southern society. But I think it also goes deeper than just slavery. Eugene Genovese wrote about this, and I guess probably the most famous articulation is Alan Tate's. But, you know, there was some affinity between elite Southern culture and Catholicism. You know, the view of society as organically related, as hierarchically structured, you know, at a fundamental level, I think elite Southern Protestants and Catholics saw the world in very similar ways. You know, slavery was part of that. You know, slavery was one of those hierarchies, one of those patriarchal systems. But it was really part, I think, of a broader worldview in which Catholics and Protestants actually had a lot in common. And I think that also facilitated Catholicism's entry into the South.
So after the Civil War, and especially by the time we get to the early part of the 20th century, I really start to see anti-Catholicism taking off in the South. You know, we have the murder of Father James Coyle in 1921. You have Sidney Katz in Florida in 1916 become the governor on a strong anti-Catholic message. Let me ask you to sort of step beyond your book and speculate as to what happened.
Yeah, you know, I think there is a change. In a sense, as nativism and anti-Catholicism either declines or at least changes in the North, it in a sense becomes more open and virulent in the South. You know, I think part of it is that the South as a whole changes. You know, the worldview of the Old South, the institutions on which it was based, are destroyed by the war and by Reconstruction. And so if we accept the thesis that there was an affinity between that worldview and Catholicism, then, you know, that affinity is broken. You know, that world has changed. And so the connection between the Southern way of life, the Southern view of life, and Catholicism no longer holds. At the same time, you have, of course, political changes. You know, with the occupation and the Reconstruction governments, a lot of Northerners start coming down to the South. Many of them are Catholic, so Catholicism becomes identified increasingly with sort of the Northern occupier. And of course, there are a host of other dynamics as well. But I think in general, you're right that there is a change. I saw in my own research indications that there were still striking instances of cooperation. So I think probably even in the Reconstruction period and into the early 20th century, the situation is probably more complex than, you know, just the KKK. But I think there is a change. There's a shift. And that's something I think that needs to be looked into much more thoroughly.
Well, here's my last question for you. What do you hope people take away from your book? What mark do you hope to leave?
Well, it's interesting. When I first conceived this project, I thought of it primarily as a contribution to the history of American Catholicism. Obviously, the history of American Catholicism, as it's written, focuses primarily on the North and the Midwest. And, you know, there's obviously good reasons for that. So I thought at first that I was sort of recovering the experience of these sort of forgotten Catholics. But as I continued with the project, it seemed to me that this might say more really about the South than it says about American Catholicism. And I think actually the greater contribution, I hope the greater contribution, is to our understanding of the Old South. Clearly, the Old South was religiously heterogeneous. All sorts of different religious groups could find a home there. This shows another element of how slavery shaped the South and how attitudes towards slavery were so important. And again, I think it reflects something about the Southern worldview. And I mentioned this sort of affinity with the Catholic worldview. I think that sheds a really interesting light on how at least elite Southerners saw themselves and their society. So I've sort of changed my thinking on this. I think actually this work might contribute less to the history of American Catholicism and more to our understanding of the Old South.
Well, that is a perfect place to conclude this podcast. Again, the book is Southern Crucifix, Southern Cross, Catholic-Protestant Relations in the Old South. Thank you to Andrew Stern for joining us, and thank you for listening. Have a great day.